You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 55 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. It's the Steve Scheffler edition of the Pelton Cast.
Oh, 55. Yeah. This is just like in Super Mario World.
I like that you've taught your baby fantasy genius to do this now.
This is what I'm saying is that when we were children and would play the game Super Mario World, you jump to the flag and at the last level, the little like white thing that goes up and down. If you hit it, it gives you a number, and then you have to say a Seattle athlete who is that number.
Yeah, Baby Fantasy Genius was very insistent about that when we were playing last week.
Was he really?
Kudos to
him. Wow. He's still is listing the same type of players that we would have in the 90s.
Exactly. It really hasn't progressed much. I think I might have gotten... I was going to say I thought I might have gotten a 24 and said Marshawn Lynch, but obviously that would have been Griffey. Like,
yeah,
that,
it's true.
That can't be... With all due respect to Marshawn, that can never be Marshawn.
Griffey owns 24 forever. But what are we drinking? Let's get into... We have a lot to get to.
We do, but I think we're going to get to it efficiently.
That's okay. Those are famous. Because that's what we're good at.
Those are famous last words. We are drinking the No Lie March 4th Citrus IPA, which, as you can imagine from the name, has been out for a while now. But came across this at the Beer Junction of, I think, over a month ago now. And we just haven't, there's been so much other new beer that you've had that we haven't had a chance to drink it as yet. March 4th Citrus IPA is packed with orange peel and a zesty citrus finish. That was tough for me to say. But I always enjoy zesty
citrus. Zesty's great.
We celebrate and hoist a cold one with each of our communities. No Lie, of course, based in Spokane.
Right, crack this open right here. And in the meantime, I feel like maybe a thank you is in order.
Yeah, we wanted to give our appreciation to the handful of you, most recently Steveroni14, who have left reviews on iTunes and ratings. So we very much appreciate that.
How does the jingle go? The five-star reviews jingle?
Five-star reviews.
Peltoncast, five-star reviews.
I mean, look, you know, I'm not counting on the five-star reviews staying perfect, especially now that we've actually mentioned it. You know, there's probably some haters out there who are going to go leave a
I've been trying to list a one-star review of my own.
Yeah, yeah. I thought we should have a toast here to start off with.
Okay.
To the Seattle Thunderbirds, who claimed their first WHL championship.
Really?
Beating the Regina Pats Sunday in Regina to win the series 4-2.
This is their first WHL championship ever?
It's kind of hard to believe, but yes it is.
You're telling me that they conquered everybody?
They conquered everybody.
They conquered Lethbridge?
They did.
Medicine Hat?
Yep.
Kootenay?
Yes.
Wait, are there any other funny ones? Those are probably the best. Oh, Moose Jaw? Did I say Moose Jaw?
I think you might have gotten Moose Jaw.
Brandon Wheat?
Hold on.
I think they're in Brandon, not a city called Brandon Wheat. They're the Brandon Wheat Kings.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's the case.
Like, I would believe anything. I would believe any name of any Canadian city.
You're a bigger fan of the Kamloops Blazers?
They conquered Kamloops, Victoria, Kelowna, Prince Kelowna George.
Wait, did you get Medicine Hat in there?
I'm pretty sure I mentioned Medicine Hat.
You must have gotten Medicine Hat.
And such major American cities as Everett and Spokane and the Tri-Cities?
Yeah.
All three of the Tri-Cities?
All three of them. Pasco, Richland, and Kennewick.
Kennewick, too?
All bow to the Seattle Thunderbirds.
Wow.
Who are actually based in Kent. The Thunderbirds now will advance to face the winners of the Ontario Hockey League, the Quebec Major Junior Hockey League, which it sounds like a contradiction, the Major Junior Hockey League.
it sounds like it's teenagers playing. And also, this is zesty.
It's the Memorial Cup, which is hosted this year by the Windsor Spitfires.
Oh.
So those four teams will play in a round-robin format to determine the champion of junior hockey.
Wow, congrats.
So there you go.
Maybe someday we have to go to one of their games.
Yes. Also today, on a very different note, we're pouring one out for an old friend. And that
Who's
old
that?
Friend is the Young Pope.
Ah.
Which will not be actually having a second season, as it turns out.
But there's a spinoff show that was announced, right?
So instead what they're doing, is was reported today... by HBO, is they will just be, you know, it was originally designed, The Young Pope, as kind of a mini series, a one-off, and then it was so phenomenally popular and successful, mostly due to this podcast, that they wanted to do a second season. But instead of bringing back Jude Law as The Young Pope, since that story had kind of already played out,
okay,
they're going to cast an entirely new pope and call it now The New Pope.
There we go. I'm hoping there's all sorts of popes, just like every ethnicity a pope. Like, I want a gay pope. I want everything that you could have with the word pope after it.
The Troy Mayne pope.
That's what they're going to get to eventually.
They'll be really going deep at that point. But yes, no, I agree with you. I think as much as I would love to have seen Jude Law play the young pope again, because he was amazing in that role, I also think it would have been kind of forced if they had done like a follow-up to what they did.
Yes.
So
the young pope was a perfect series, right?
Right.
It was a perfect series of episodes, and Jude Law was perfect as the young pope. Have they told us who the new pope is going to be?
They have not yet cast the new pope.
I feel like Donald Glover is going to be busy, but he has to be the new pope, right?
I feel like you've got to, like, The Ringer had a piece with their suggestions for who should be the new pope.
Was Riz Ahmed one of them?
No.
Okay.
But that's the thing, is like they almost exclusively listed Americans, and it's like you can't go back-to-back American popes. There's not ever been a real pope.
Especially American. After what happened with the young pope.
Right. After the scandalous conclusion.
I don't see them going back to another American.
I see them going the exact opposite direction.
So you're
as
saying,
Italian as possible.
Yeah, the show should just be all in Italian next year.
But no, I don't think that actually would be there's been too many Italian popes.
too many. That's kind of a hot take.
Too many to make it interesting, not too many.
There's been too many.
I mean, I can't speak to who should have been pope. It's like, I feel like an African pope would be interesting.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I can't.
A Southeast Asian pope? That's like a growing hotbed of Catholicism. So, yeah.
Okay.
I think really explore the studio space.
Okay. Well, I can't wait to find out who that pope is.
And I can't wait for the bingo square. Loyal listener Ben B to change the bingo square from young pope to new pope.
Okay, great. You also mentioned Troy Mayne pope, which just felt superfluous.
It was necessary. I disagree.
But also we're moving briskly, right?
We are.
Let's get into burgers really quick, because we have a bit of a sad story.
We do. We have a tragic story. So the original plan that you devised, that I was never quite on board with, was trying to go to the People's Burger before the U2 concert we attended on Sunday night.
There's just way too many people. That was a terrible idea.
It was the too many People's Burger. Instead,
and that was good.
You ate burgers at one of our favorite spots.
At Loretta's.
Yes.
Yes. Which were great.
Yeah.
Perfect 100 every time.
Even though we didn't actually rate them a perfect 100. I didn't eat before the concert at all. Didn't eat the rest of the day after like doing the Mother's Day brunch buffet thing. So I was always planning to go on Tuesday, and originally I was thinking I would go to the stadium location, but then I saw on their website that they also have on Tuesdays, they have the truck at Westlake Park, right near your office in Seattle's historic Paramount Theater.
Or do they?
Right. So I proposed that we would go. And I go down there, I park, we walk over from your office, and lo and behold, no food truck.
There's no People's Burger. Now, I have a couple questions for you. Actually, it's only one question for you.
Okay.
Does this exclude the People's Burger from the list? Is it gone now?
I don't know if it's gone, but it's definitely a demerit. I mean, first off, I was thinking this was kind of a bad time to go because of the fact that even though it stopped raining, it was still bitterly cold outside this afternoon.
That doesn't change the quality of the burger.
But
Seattle's best burger will taste good in rain, sleet, snow, hail.
I mean, I agree with that, but I'm saying I would rate it at least 3 points. No. I mean, the burger itself should taste the same, but I'm saying my grade would probably be 3 points higher, I'm guessing, if I ate it on a sunny day outside from a food truck.
That'll be interesting to look at if all of a sudden, I feel like we've hit kind of some of the like...
But not all these places are outdoor places.
Okay. But if we hit like an outdoor place over the summer, like if we go on my birthday to Linda's and it's like 83 degrees and perfect out there, that's going to be a pretty good rating for a burger.
For sure.
Yeah.
It is definitely an unfair advantage.
So instead of going to the People's Burger...
We decided to add a location to the list. It's not we've already added many locations to the list thanks to your feedback on Twitter.
Let's get to that in a second.
Okay.
Let's talk about this first.
This is not a place that's on our list because we aren't doing national burger chains, but we have talked at length about the fact that they put a Steak and Shake downtown. I think you went to it at one point, right?
I've been there. This is my third time today.
Okay. I had not been. And as we discussed on the fast food podcast with Nate Duncan, the only time I went to Steak and Shake in Indianapolis, I had given up red meat for Lent, so I had to order chicken sandwiches.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So I'd never had a Steak and Shake burger in my life before today.
And what did you think?
It was pretty good.
Really?
Yeah.
If you were grading it on the scale of what we're grading these burgers on,
I think about an 85.
I was going to give it an 80.
And the biggest the biggest demerit is the fact that, so we had what?
You're giving out a lot of demerits today.
Yes. The signature steak burger. And the steak burger and fries was $9.99. So then I ordered a shake on top of that and ended up paying like $17, which is basically the same amount you're paying if you go to like one of the nice burger restaurants on our list.
Yeah, that's insane. And I think that's one of the biggest complaints about the Steak and Shake location.
Right, and I don't think it's universal to Steak and Shake, certainly.
Right, like, I mean, if let's say you went to Dick's, right, which is, I guess, maybe the Seattle equivalent of Steak and Shake. I think most people think of it as almost even like a Denny's, though.
Yeah, it's got a little bit more of a diner-y feel, and that's certainly what the burger is like, where it's more of, you know, more diner-y than more of the, you know, the fancy burger style, I guess I'd say.
I'm not sure if I really understand what makes it a steak burger outside of it being kind of crunchy on the outside.
Well, they're using steak in the burger.
It just tastes like a burger.
I agree. It's not noticeable. And yes, although the crunchiness was nice.
You like the crunchiness.
Oh, yeah. You didn't like it?
The crunchiness is fine. I don't know. Like, it wasn't big enough for me. I probably could have eaten two of those burgers.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
That was pretty big for me. I don't know.
Also, I can't get behind a burger that doesn't have secret sauce.
Yeah.
If you just have, I mean, ketchup is great.
I thought the ketchup was like very well proportioned.
I just need something else though.
That's reasonable.
It was a totally fine burger. It doesn't stand out at all, but like, I mean, it's edible for sure.
Wow. That's like the faintest possible phrase. You just damned with the faintest possible phrase.
No, I'm saying like if I'm around that Steak and Shake or if I'm in the Midwest or whatever and see a Steak and Shake, I would be open to going again.
We were deliberating whether to go to the Steak and Shake or walk to a more distant burger place that was on the list. And let me tell you, when we walked by, like it was calling, speaking
to you.
The siren call of the Steak and Shake. Because I had never seen it before, weirdly. I'd never even passed it on the street.
It's a weird street.
So
you weren't hanging out at the Ross looking over there?
Well, I used to work two blocks away. I spent an entire year working two blocks away when the Sonics were downtown.
So. Okay, so next week
I'm familiar with the area.
We're going for my birthday to Linda's.
Well, wait. Are we doing that next week or is that going to be 2 weeks from now?
I have no idea what my birthday is. Is that not next week? That's next week.
No, your birthday is next week, but it's on. We're going on, what, Thursday, I want
to
say?
Oh, so you're saying we need to eat a burger before then.
Yeah, which I think is good also because then that subsequent weekend, I'm going to be out of town and consuming massive amounts of barbecue in Kansas City.
Oh, man.
So that'll be fun. I forgot
that you're going to barbecue. That you're going to Kansas City.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I'm so excited to talk about barbecue.
So we may need to come up with something else to do this weekend.
Okay, well, let me read off to you some of the new burgers which were added. And let me know if I forgot one of them that you thought was notable.
Okay.
Okay, so we had Jack's, Tipsy Cow.
I don't think Jack's qualified. Jack's Grill is...
Oh, you're ruling Jack's out?
It's a sit-down restaurant that has a burger, not a burger place.
I'm much more lenient. As with fast food, I'm much more lenient with this than you are.
Although John Howie Steak is really trying to convince us to come in on Twitter.
Where do you stand on Brave Horse Tavern?
I think Brave Horse Tavern is a yes because of the fact that it is primarily a burger restaurant.
All right, I'm currently deleting Jack's and changing it to Brave Horse Tavern.
Even though, weirdly, I've never had a burger at Brave Horse Tavern.
I've never been there before.
I've only had like their pretzel ham sandwich, which is very good.
I'm into that. Yeah. Okay, so Brave Horse Tavern, Tipsy Cow, which is on the east side.
Yes.
The restaurant Burger Bar, BRGR. Yeah. Which is not affiliated, apparently, with Gordon Ramsay's burger.
No, it is absolutely not. That was definitely new to you.
I'd seen this online and been like, I would have added it to the list, but I've been like, well, I'm not doing this Gordon Ramsay's burger place. But found out that it's completely unrelated. And that's in Pioneer Square?
Yes.
Burger Fenia, which is a food truck which sounds like it's often at the Rubens Brews in Ballard.
Yes.
And sounds like a pretty interesting one to me.
That's. I didn't like that they referred to themselves as Seattle's best burger on the website. Look, we'll be the judge of that, okay? Yeah. Let's all remain calm.
Coastline.
Which is in West Seattle. That's maybe a good candidate for this weekend.
I have a very busy weekend.
Oh, do you? Okay, well.
It's gonna be complicated to figure out. I don't know what we're going to choose. Scooters, which is kind of a divey place in Ballard.
Okay.
Have you seen that?
I don't think I looked at the website or anything.
There were a couple of these last two at the end, Scooters and Broiler Bay, which is in Bellevue, are burgers that are like old school those cities burgers, right? Uh-huh. So like Broiler Bay is an old school Bellevue burger from before it was whatever Bellevue is now.
Just everyone going to Bellevue Square if are going there on Saturday was any indication.
But it's not a bougie burger place, right?
Yes.
And Scooters in the same way, is harkening back, it seems like, to Ballard's working class roots.
So it's made of cod then.
I'm fascinated by both of these because I never heard of either. All of the new restaurants I really hadn't heard of before. And considering that like Scooters is in Ballard and has pretty good reviews, I was surprised that I never heard of it.
All right, so do you have a determination after going through this list?
No, do you?
I mean, I gave a suggestion. You summarily shot it down.
I think we should meet for lunch one day when I'm at work and do 206 Burger Company.
All right, we can do that.
I think that's the winner because we talked about it today. I was pretty excited about it. And if we have a little bit more time and we know specifically that we're going there.
Yeah.
I feel like that's the one.
All right.
Okay. Well, there we go. All right. Thank you again to everybody who submitted burger recommendations. If there's anything that I forgot, we'll go back and add it. And also, it's always open to ideas.
Yeah. Yeah, we're always on the lookout for good burgers. Should we move on and talk about the NBA?
Briskly.
The story of the NBA right now, point guards from the University of Washington, as best I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
In the Eastern Conference, Isaiah Thomas helping lead the Celtics to the Eastern Conference Finals. The winning game 7 the other night against the Washington Wizards pours him out for loyal listener Ben B.
I was going to say, I feel like the story for that one was not a point guard from the University of Washington. Might have been a Washington State player, but...
Oh, are you saying Kelly Olynyk?
Yes.
Yeah, shout out to Kelly Olynyk, who scored 14 points in the fourth quarter to help the Celtics seal that one. But the Celtics may be adding another University of Washington point guard, because on Tuesday night, they won the NBA draft lottery with the pick that they swapped with the Brooklyn Nets that entered with the best chance of being number one. And I would be very surprised if they drafted anyone but Markelle Fultz.
Okay, so I guess I have a series of questions for you.
Okay.
But first, just a statement, which is this kind of worked out almost exactly as we expected it to.
It definitely worked out in like the most natural way. If the Celtics take Fultz because everyone assumed that they wanted Fultz, and if the Lakers take Ball because everyone assumed that they wanted Ball. So
this is a draft lottery where the teams who are natural fits for the players who are at the top are going to get them. But then also going into that first commercial break, as if you're the NBA and you have three of your biggest franchises right there.
Right.
It's like Lakers, Celtics, Sixers.
And the Knicks just completely on the outside looking.
They thought maybe this was the year that the NBA would pull a Patrick Ewing for them. But
did you understand what happened when the Kings came up number 5 that it meant that the Sixers had swapped with them?
I mean, not really. I was probably in the Joel Embiid boat where I was not really sure what was going on.
Yeah. I mean, that was very entertaining because of the fact that it harkens back to one of the worst trades in NBA history where the Kings gave up the right to swap picks, Nick Stauskas, and their unprotected at this point 2019 first round pick.
Yes, that's the. I mean, this right here is it's two picks, whatever. It's not a huge deal.
Yeah, no, the 2019 pick, you're right, is a much bigger deal. So that was what allowed the Sixers to jump up into the top three. They don't get the Lakers pick, but I don't think it's the worst thing that they don't get it until 2018. Maybe it's Michael Porter, maybe Luka Doncic, who is.
Or maybe the Lakers are good, or better.
We'll see.
Okay, so my couple of questions for you are...
Okay.
Question number one, let's assume that they take Markelle Fultz.
Yes.
Which, like, do you want to do percentage chances if they keep the pick? What are the percentage chances they take Markelle Fultz?
Like 95.
Okay. Okay.
I am very convinced that they are a Markelle Fultz team. They're likely to keep the pick. I mean, when they were talking about trading...
Wait, don't answer my second question before I get to it. Fine. Okay, second question, how likely are they to make this pick?
I would also say like 95%.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, when they were talking about trading this pick to Chicago for Jimmy Butler or to Indiana for Paul George, they wanted, you know, they had the ability to protect it, and they wanted to put protection that they would keep the pick if it was the number one overall pick. Now that it is the number one overall pick, I don't think now they're suddenly going to be like, oh yeah, now we should trade it.
Yes.
I mean, we'll see how this series with Cleveland plays out. If, you know, if it's a very competitive series and it feels like, you know, adding one more player could put them over the top and put them in the NBA Finals, maybe that changes the math a little bit. But at this point, I still think their best window to beat Cleveland is probably a couple years down the road.
Can they sign Gordon Hayward and make this pick?
Oh yeah. Oh, they would, man, probably have to let Kelly Olynyk go to sign Gordon Hayward.
Well, too bad.
He was the hero of Game 7. But no, the pick does not affect. I mean, it's slightly more cap space now that they have the number one, but they can still clear enough.
And also, this could make them more enticing as a destination if you're Gordon Hayward.
For sure. Yeah.
Man. Okay, so question number three is, how does this affect Isaiah Thomas?
I mean, it's certainly not great for his long-term chances of being the Celtics starting point guard, but I think it's going to take long enough for Markelle Fultz to get to the point, assuming that he's the pick, to get to the point Isaiah Thomas is currently at, and they have the ability to play those two guys together because of Fultz's size, although I think people kind of overrate, you know, how effective he'd be at a shooting guard. I think he does, you know, need the ball in his hands to be at, to maximize his value, not to be effective, but to maximize his value. So as a result of that, I mean, I certainly don't think it's realistic that they trade him this summer, given where they, how competitive they are.
Or don't resign him, right?
Well, he's not a free agent until next summer.
Oh, okay.
So that's when they'll have the decision to make. I still think they'll probably resign him, but you'll have a lot more information this time a year from now.
Is Isaiah immediately asking for a deal, though? Like, this summer rolls around.
I don't think so.
You don't think he's asking for an extension?
Well, no, I don't think an extension makes much sense for him because he would not be able to get as many years as he could get if he re-signed as a free agent. That's the big factor that would keep him from really pursuing an extension. And it doesn't make sense for the Celtics because they're going to want to go out and sign someone with that cap space.
Okay, so let's look in the tea leaves, right? All of these things happen. Isaiah Thomas will be there next year, right? They're probably not trading him. They draft Markelle and they sign Gordon Hayward. Where do they rank in the NBA?
I mean, it depends sort of how Cleveland, what happens with LeBron and his aging next year. I think it puts them in the, you know, it makes them a more serious threat to Cleveland. I don't know if I'd say it pushes them ahead of Cleveland.
Okay. It seems kind of crazy that that would be the case, given that they're the number one seed.
Yeah. They're kind of a fake number one seed, if we're being real about it.
Okay. Like the Huskies.
I mean, they were down 2-0 to Chicago in the first round of the playoffs. Like, there was some bad luck involved there, but, you know, let's all remain calm.
Okay. There was a pretty exciting draft lottery, though.
It was. It was very much so, especially with the Huskies having something at stake. So the third UW point guard who's in the headlines right now, DeJounte Murray, playing extended minutes for the San Antonio Spurs in Tony Parker's absence. When we last talked, I think he had just gotten a DNP in Game 5 against San Antonio. But then with Kawhi Leonard out of the lineup in Game 6, Greg Popovich turned him for extended minutes, and DeJounte Murray was incredible in that game, as were all the Spurs.
Superstar DeJounte Murray.
All right. Let's remain calm. He did shoot, I think, 1-for-9 from the field tonight. Also, it was like a minus 28.
But wait, who wasn't?
That's fair point. Oh, minus 27. He finished 3-of-12 for the field. A very strange stat line. He really stuffed the box score. 8 points, 6 rebounds, 6 assists, 4 steals, 5 turnovers. So there was plenty of good and bad for DeJounte Murray tonight.
That's the DeJounte we know and love.
But certainly you never would have imagined this time a year ago that he's playing 27 minutes in a conference finals game. It's crazy.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
But he is right now, when he was drafted, it was funny because we talked about this when he was drafted. Where DeJounte Murray was taken, if he would have gone to almost any other team, people probably would have ignored him, right?
Yeah.
But he gets drafted by the Spurs, and everybody says, whoa, what a great pick.
Oh, yeah.
He looks like their point guard of the future. And everybody was right. Somehow everybody was right about this, and he looks like their point guard of the future.
We still got a long ways to go, but the early returns have been remarkably promising, all things considered.
Can he shoot yet? A little bit?
A little.
Okay.
A little. I would say that my hot take that Matisse Thybulle was going to have a better NBA career, not aged well. is not
good. Look, give it time. Give it time.
Yeah, I'm not gonna call it off just yet.
This is not just a better career than DeJounte Murray. This is also better than Marquise Chris.
No, I didn't say that.
I thought you said better than any player on that team.
No, you said that, maybe. You said I said that. Not you. You actually thought that.
I'm taking your hot takes and making them just a little bit hotter.
Just turning them up. Look, we'll get to hot takes, okay? We're not there yet. While we're on the topic of the NBA, we should talk about the latest developments in the Seattle Arena front.
Okay.
And, you know, I think the story of last week was Chris Hansen's group going on the offensive. He had previously, as we discussed, gone on ESPN Radio to talk about the merits of the Soto Arena project. Wally Walker last week went on KJR to talk about it. And then on Thursday, leading up to an open house at KXP for Oakview and Seattle Partners to talk about their key arena renovation proposals, the Chris Hansen group put out on their website, sonicsarena.com, a comparison of the proposals that I think fleshed out some of the things we were confused about discussing these projects in the past, like mm-hmm. specifically kind of the tax implications.
Yes.
So their determination is that...
Are these to be completely trusted?
I mean, I think there is a certain degree of spin, and then in some cases they're posing questions that I think, you know, ultimately the Oakview and Seattle Partners Group may be able to clear up just things where you can't entirely tell what the meaning of the document is. And the other question, I haven't been able to get a good answer on this, is whether the Oakview and Seattle Partners proposals, are they just take it or leave it proposals, or are they a starting point for negotiations? Because if you look at what happened with the memorandum of understanding between Hansen and the city, that evolved substantially yes. from when it was first presented to the public to when the city council finally voted to approve it. You know, it became a lot more favorable to the city. Mm-hmm. And so we'll see if something similar happens with these proposals. I have heard some suggestion that there may not be the same degree of wiggle room in them. But anyway, the most interesting aspect of this is we talked about the tax situation. So the Soto Arena, the Hansen Group, is asking for a waiver of admissions tax under the logic that otherwise that tax would not be paid if there wasn't admissions because there wasn't yes. an arena. And also perhaps... Some reduction in their B&O tax from the state of Washington, but they would still be paying taxes on arena construction, sales tax on concessions and merchandise sold in the arena, property tax, lease excise tax, parking tax, and then also paying for their utilities, which Seattle Partners specifically requested to be reimbursed for, and I think Oakview, the language was a little bit unclear. So overall, they estimate that you know, the difference in terms of what they'd be paying in taxes would be $40 million in upfront taxes related to the construction and permitting, of which $11 to $12 million would go to the city of Seattle, and then $10 to $13 million annually in taxes, of which $4 to $5 million would go to the city of Seattle. So that puts this comparison with the Seattle Partners and Oakview proposals in a slightly different light, especially, you know, if you're making the case that the reason to favor a key arena renovation is because something is going to have to be done with key arena anyway, and it's going to cost the city, you know, I think the estimate was $150 million if you were to turn it into a smaller arena that was focused on concerts and then the Seattle Storm continuing to play there. So some of that money that you would be spending there in that hypothetical possibility is contrasted with the money you'd be bringing in terms of tax revenues with the Soto Arena that the key arena renovation proposals have asked to have waived yes. or reinvested into the arena operations.
And they would also still make money from that small arena.
Yes, some money, yeah. It's unclear how much. So it'll be interesting. I haven't heard the city council or the mayor comment on this yet in terms of, you know, what they think it means. The one thing we did hear from Mayor Murray is that he said at this open house that he plans to have a recommendation between the Seattle Partners and Oakview proposals well before the end of June, which was the original deadline that was set for that decision. So,
Were there any other main takeaways from the Chris Hansen comparison, or was it mostly just the taxes?
You know, they also raised some questions about cost overruns with construction, which is certainly a consideration, especially with the Oakview group, because of the fact that it entails digging down much deeper than previously has been done on that Seattle Center site, you know, the deeper you go into the ground, the more risks naturally that, you know, come up with that are associated with that. Whereas the Seattle Partners plan, by extending the roof out, wouldn't necessarily capture that same degree of risk. So,
and what about Key Arena going forward?
So an interesting bit of news that King 5's Chris Daniels reported tonight is that the Seattle Storm are close to agreeing to a new lease, which would keep them at Key Arena through 2028. Previously, their lease ran through 2018 that they had originally agreed to after becoming independent after the Sonics moved to Oklahoma City. This would require council approval, but you know, probably I think a likely to approve it. So some interesting aspects of this related to the possibility of renovation. The Storm would get $100,000 each year from the city starting in 2018 is compensation for the possibility of being relocated if the arena was renovated. And then if they were, in fact, displaced for, you know, a season or two because of this.
So they just get $100,000 starting 2018 through 2028.
That's how I'm reading the document.
For nothing. Just because they might get relocated. Wow.
I don't know what to tell you.
But it's also something to consider when you're considering this versus the other group.
Right.
Because that's $1 million, right?
I'm not entirely sure it's for the life of the, but it does appear to be, yeah.
And I understand $1 million is not that much money in terms of what we're talking here, but it's just completely a sunk cost.
Yes. So then if they were in fact displaced by renovation of Key Arena, the city would reimburse the Storm for up to $2.6 million per year, not including playoff games, in terms of the costs associated with having to play somewhere else. I'd guess probably Heck Ed they would play at is just a wild guess. No inside info on that one. And then also any lost revenue that, you know, they didn't bring in because they weren't playing at Key Arena. So
but they basically look at their profits year to year.
Yeah, in terms of their revenue from home games, yeah.
And then if they go to the playoffs, it would be slightly more.
I think it's $50,000 for first round games and $60,000 beyond that.
So if they did renovate, they could be looking at something like $3 million for 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, I think it'd probably be a maximum of two, depending on the timetable.
A maximum of 2 years.
I mean, you know, unless something goes wrong with the renovation process.
We don't know what's down there. So that could be another $6 million that is going just out.
Yes.
How did the Storm negotiate this deal?
I don't know. I mean, the previous lease was pretty favorable from my understanding.
Do you think that this was negotiated with the thought that Key Arena probably won't be renovated?
No, I think the reason that this is in here is because of the fact that everyone expects that it will be.
Okay.
So there you go.
That is very interesting.
Yeah, that caught me a little off guard. I probably shouldn't have because I was working for the team when they signed that original lease, but wasn't thinking that it was coming up after next year. All right, I think that about covers us on NBA Arena Talk. Now it's time to turn up the heat.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at ya.
Many people said last week that this team was on the brink of a 20-game win streak, at least. Everything looked perfect. And then what did the Mariners do?
What did the Mariners do?
They go into Toronto, last place in the AL East Toronto, and get swept in four games? A four-game sweep
that
to Toronto?
Bad.
And then they come back home. This team is in total chaos. Every single player is injured. They come back home. They barely win a game that they shouldn't have won against the A's. Lose the next night. And everybody is injured.
I mean, at this point, I think it's actually easier to list the players who aren't injured for the Mariners, at least in terms of like notable names.
We are talking Felix, Iwakuma, MVP Mitch Haniger, Cy Young winner James Paxton, John Segura spent time on the disabled list, Robinson Cano to the disabled list. They are starting somebody at catcher named Tuffy. I think he's their bullpen catcher. There's a hot take for you. But the question must be asked right now. Is this team cursed? And I'm not talking metaphorically. I'm talking literally. Is this team cursed? And the answer is definitively yes.
Okay, so the Red Sox had the curse of the Bambino.
Yes.
In the Cubs case, it was what, the goat?
The goat. The curse of the Billy Goat. Yeah. We don't know exactly what it is. Oh. Maybe. You think it's a Sonics curse?
I definitely think it's a Sonics curse.
I think there's a chance it's a Sonics curse, but it goes back pretty far. We're talking, it goes back to 2002. The Sonics were here. They're winning playoff games since the Mariners have been to the playoffs.
Yeah, I don't know if I would describe like signing Jeff Cirillo as a curse.
Maybe that's the curse. I don't know what it is. We're waiting to pinpoint it. It could be a Sonics curse. Maybe they introduced Alex Rodriguez to PEDs, throwing that out there. Probably true. Maybe it's a curse of Lou Piniella. Don't know. Maybe they're cursed because of Randy Johnson. Because I think that 2001 season might be part of the curse.
The 116 wins during the regular season to like record tying wins. That was a real long curse.
The curse, as I know it, sets you up just to fail. The curse gets your hopes high and then beats you down.
I would say that's what's happened with Edwin Diaz.
There's another curse, the bullpen. They're bringing it back to the 1990s with this bullpen. They cannot find relief.
Oh, wow. Wow, that was very radio right there. Are you saying they're going to trade for Heathcliff Slocum and Mike Timlin?
They're trading the whole future for Heathcliff Slocum and Mike Timlin. They are leveraging it. Jason Veritek is gone. This toughy guy is out of here.
Do you even know his last name?
It was something very long.
Ghost Switch. How do I know that and you don't know that?
You study the bullpen catcher a little bit more than I do.
Clearly.
They cannot find relief. Edwin Diaz is out as the closer. Could not close these games. Two in a row. And then tonight, Steve Cishek can't do it either.
Wow.
I am telling you, this is reminding me of the worst of Bobby Ayala.
Oh, wow.
We are going back to those times. They are going to leverage their entire future just looking for a bullpen.
All right, you got any non-hot takes here?
Not really. They're all hot. Wait, what hot take would you have?
Wait, what non-hot take?
What non-hot take would you have? The hot takes are too accurate.
I suppose it's true. Mitch Haniger might be back next week.
Great.
As they go on the road. So there you go.
Do you know who's starting for this team?
Not really.
Pitching-wise. I think from the original starting rotation.
We had a question yesterday where you posed to me, could I name more than two members of the Mariners starting rotation? All I could come up with was Ariel Miranda.
Yeah, Ariel Miranda. I think from the original starting rotation to begin the year, only Yovani Gallardo has left. Drew Smyly has gone down. Felix has gone down. Iwakuma has gone down. Paxton's gone down. There's four right there.
Yeah, and you only start five. So by definition, only one left. All right, anything else on the Mariners? I don't know if it rises to the level of curse, but Seattle Sounders continuing to struggle.
They did win the MLS Cup last year.
No, it did. It can't rise to the level of curse. But they're continuing to struggle this season in their defense. Now, after a 4-1 loss Saturday at Chicago, which I think was probably the nadir of this stretch here, now just 1 point from their last three matches, and they've dropped it to ninth in the West, even in points with in points per match with expansion club Minnesota FC.
Ooh.
Now, the good news is they still look a lot better in expected goal differential on AmericanSoccerAnalysis.com, but they're down to sixth there. They were first after that LA Galaxy win when it seemed like they were kind of riding high. Part of the issue, injuries and suspensions, they continue to shuffle the back line. Sounders got Chad Marshall back on Saturday, and Brad Evans did see his first minutes since the MLS Cup. First minutes of the season, but Roman Torres and O'Neill Fisher remain out, and then Jovan Jones will miss Wednesday's game due to suspension. So not an ideal time. For the first time all season, the Sounders will be playing a midweek match in a stretch of three matches in 8 days here. Wednesday night, tonight, if you're listening to this as it first comes out, they'll be at Sporting Kansas City, and then Saturday, Real Salt Lake. So Sporting Kansas City tied for first in the Western Conference right now with 19 points, though they're third in points per match. They've played a couple more games than some of those other teams in there. Fifth in expected goal differential. And you watch in this one for Dom Dwyer, who has long been a thorn in the Sounders' side, scoring a lot of crucial goals against them.
It's and been a lot of Dom Dwyer.
A lot of Dom Dwyer. And leads the team with five goals this year. Real Salt Lake It's interesting. Over their last four matches, they have been outscored 13-1, which is not good. That's my advanced soccer analysis for you. Now, that's coincided with their goalkeeper, Nick Raimondo, who's kept goal at times for the U.S. men's national team. He left during the first game of that stretch in the 58th minute, then has missed the last three.
He's like Kawhi Leonard.
And clearly they have... He's like Kawhi Leonard only during the Warriors series, not during the Rockets series. But they do hope to get him back. They're playing NYCFC on Wednesday, so it sounds like he probably should be back for that game on Saturday, in which case Real Salt Lake will be a much more formidable foe.
Okay, so this is a tough week facing the number one team in the West, right?
Yeah.
And then another match, which the Sounders should win. But my question for you is, I know this is a very long season.
Such a long season.
When should we start getting nervous about this team?
I think it's okay. A little nervous about the team right now. I mean, I don't think it's time for full-on panic. I was reading Sounder at Heart, this Sounders blog. I think they've reached full-on panic
there. Are they calling for Brian Schmitzer's head?
I was reading Dave Clark, who is the moderator of that site, the lead writer, and he did not call for Brian Schmitzer's head, but said that there were people calling for his head. So, you know, what happened to the five-year grace period? That's not even a five-month grace period anymore for Brian Schmitzer.
But you think this is the point where maybe the center should start feeling a little bit of heat?
I mean, we are almost a third of the way. After this week, they will be more than a third of the way through the MLS regular season.
And just because of the turnaround that they had last year doesn't mean anything this year.
It doesn't guarantee anything. I mean, again, the good news is they're playing much better than their record would indicate. The bad news is your record still matters.
And they're losing matches. You know, it's not a draw.
Yeah.
Drawing matches is one thing, but losing and picking up 0 points is a much different situation.
Yeah. And especially losing by 3 goals. I mean, you know, there's some controversial calls in there. There's guys getting sent off. But still, you don't want to lose a lot of matches by 3 goals. That's my other hot take.
Okay. Okay.
Try to avoid that.
Well, this will be a telling weekend for them, though, facing these two teams. One that you would expect them to lose and one that you would expect them to win, and seeing what they come out of it looking like, I think will help point us toward the rest of the season.
Yeah, if you don't come out with at least two points from these two games, and ideally three, then it starts to be a greater level of concern. Okay. Quickly on the Seattle Storm, opening up their season last weekend, lost 78-68 at Los Angeles, playing without Sue Bird, who's still coming back from that knee surgery. And then Brianna Stewart also sat out that game as she's coming back from a sprained MCL she suffered playing in China. But Stewie was back in the lineup for her season debut on Sunday night as the Storm beat the Indiana Fever 87-82 in their home opener.
Nice.
They'll have this week off and should be enough time for Sue to get back healthy. They're expecting to have her back next Sunday when they take on the Washington Mystics and Elena Della Don, who was traded to Washington over the offseason. So there you go.
Okay. A little bit of Seahawks news.
Yeah, kind
of. It's rumblings. Ooh. Rumblings of news.
Should we start by talking about the rookie camp that was held last weekend?
Okay.
So some interesting takeaways from that. Shaquille Griffin, I think, is one of the players to watch. You know, Malik McDowell, I don't know, I would say that we know what we have in him, but we kind of know the role he's going to be used in.
Yes.
As part of the rotation on the defensive line and certainly a factor on passing downs. But Shaquille Griffin, I think, is someone who's got kind of the most variable role of the rookies, practicing at right cornerback, where he's got a chance to emerge as the starter at that position with Deshaun Jedd out of the lineup.
Kind of insane to think that they'd be starting a rookie at cornerback next year, but I you can't rule it out.
Yeah, I mean, especially with Jeremy Lane coming off a down season and probably being more effective in the slot anyway.
He might have the inside lane to the starting job next year.
Yeah, I don't know if I would go that far. Also at cornerback, Carroll noted that Mike Tyson, who they drafted as a safety and are moving him to cornerback, reminds him physically of Byron Maxwell. So that was a telling comment, I thought, there. The last note on the rookies there, you know, one of the interesting competitions is at quarterback, where there's a chance to possibly compete with Trevon Boykin, and we'll see who else might be part of that competition. They brought in Skylar Howard out of West Virginia and signed him as an undrafted free agent. And then Carol said after the weekend that one of the tryout players in camp, Michael Birdsong, actually graded out better than both Howard and Jake Heaps, who was with the team in training camp last year. So they ended up waiving Howard after the weekend.
Where did Mike Birdsong go?
So he started his career at James Madison, which is an FCS school.
Okay.
Played 2 years there, transferred up to Marshall, and split time there during his one season at Marshall. And then went back to FCS as a grad transfer and finished his career at Tennessee Tech, where last season he completed 62% of his passes for 7.4 yards per attempt.
I was going to say that I think I've heard of him, but I haven't.
Nope, you definitely have not heard of him.
I've barely heard of the schools that he played at.
I am, suffice it to say, I'm pretty skeptical that he's going to be an NFL caliber quarterback after researching his career. Yeah, pretty skeptical on that one. And then the other player worth discussing, perhaps a second-year player who didn't see any action for the Seahawks during the regular season last year, was on the practice squad, Kenny Lawler, seventh-round pick at wide receiver out of Cal, who Carol says has added 15 to 17 pounds, which A, is weirdly specific range, and B, encouraging for his size because he was someone who was pretty svelte previously.
You saw good things about him. Also, did you see anything about Amara Darbo?
Not a lot, no.
I thought he was somebody who stood out in rookie camp.
Okay.
And seemed maybe a little bit more prepared to start playing at NFL level right away.
He certainly got the opportunity there, I think. All right. That noted, let's talk about the real story this week, which is Pete Carroll telling ESPN Radio, I assume this was Brock and Salk, although I didn't actually listen to the interview, that they were asking about Colin Kaepernick and Robert Griffin III, who are both out there on the market as experienced quarterbacks and possible backup options for Russell Wilson. And Carroll's response was, "We're looking at everybody," which is a very Pete Carroll response and might not mean anything, except that subsequently we saw a report from Mike Silver of the NFL Network that John Schneider reached out to Kaepernick's agent last Friday. So this seems like it might be a real thing.
Finally!
Yeah, we talked about this several months ago.
I've been wanting this for a very long time, and it makes perfect sense for all parties involved.
Well, I mean, I think whether it makes perfect sense is still to be determined based on the salary desires.
I mean, I suppose that's true, but also we're talking about a quarterback who hasn't been signed yet, and it's almost June.
And that's why I think this conversation has started to take place in earnest. You know, not because the Seahawks are suddenly interested in Kaepernick, but now that it's after the draft, you know, it's becoming clear that there's not going to be the interest in him that he was hoping for.
He's not in line for a starting job anywhere.
Whether it's because he's being blackballed or it's actually because of his performance, you know, that market just hasn't materialized, and the Seahawks are in position to potentially benefit from other teams. I don't know if what the right word is here, but bias, I don't know.
Benefit from other teams' bias. So where do you stand on Colin Kaepernick as a player?
I mean, as a starting quarterback, I think he's probably fairly marginal at this stage of his career. But as a backup quarterback, I think he would be, you know, far and away the best backup the Seahawks have had for Russell Wilson, with all due respect to Tarvaris Jackson.
One of, if not the best backup quarterbacks in the NFL.
And then especially you look at the fact that there's the similarities in terms of, you know, his and Russell Wilson's ability to make plays with their feet. You know, it gives you, I think the Seahawks value that kind of continuity in their quarterback, which is, you know, part of the reason they were attracted to Trevon Boykin.
So just looking at Colin Kaepernick's DVOA over the last four or five seasons, he really hasn't had a great passing season since 2013,
right,
but has consistently been one of the best running quarterbacks in the NFL, which you have to factor in as part of his value and something that, you know, given the game plan that they have for Russell, that if, God forbid, worst case scenario, the worst thing ever happened, Russell Wilson got hurt. I'm going to knock on wood even just saying it. But I would go into those games with Colin Kaepernick as the starting quarterback and not feel like the Seahawks didn't have a chance to win.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I mean, it depends on a lot of factors, the rest of the team, how the defense looks, etc. But if the rest of the team is pretty solid all around, you could have Colin Kaepernick as your starting quarterback and be a playoff team.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think the other interesting factor that makes him a good fit in Seattle has been talked about at length on Twitter this week, is his low interception rate. You wouldn't know it based on his willingness to throw the ball at Richard Sherman. Very good. at avoiding interceptions, which certainly Pete Carroll values. A little more tendency to fumble, but then that's kind of been the case with Wilson as well at times during his career.
And then also there's been a lot of discussion, especially from people like Michael Bennett, about the cultural fit with the Seahawks.
Yeah, Bennett called the Seattle the perfect place for Kaepernick, which I think is pretty much what we're all thinking.
It's kind of crazy how quickly we've changed on this. There's so many things you would have never predicted 3-4 years ago that we'd be very excited about the idea of the Seahawks signing Colin Kaepernick.
Or drafting a bunch of players who played for Jim Harbaugh. Although I guess they already had Doug Baldwin and Richard Sherman, so they've benefited from plenty of Harbaugh
players. Pretty good at Jim Harbaugh players. But yeah. But I just think it makes too much sense across the board. And also, you have a quarterback in Russell Wilson who seems like a pretty secure guy. He doesn't seem like he's going to be threatened by Colin Kaepernick being around.
Yeah, I have. Here's how much I worry about that. Zero.
But it is something you would worry about with other quarterbacks. Yes. You just don't worry about it with Russell Wilson.
No. Okay, so how much money would you be willing to pay Colin Kaepernick at most? The Seahawks have...
$2.5 million.
Okay. That's a reasonable number.
What is your number? Is it different?
I might be willing to go up to three, I guess.
Having a very good backup quarterback is an important thing.
It is.
I mean, it might have meant, you know, if Trevon Boykin wasn't the backup last year, it might have meant that Russell Wilson took a month off in September and actually got healthy for the rest of the season. And if Colin Kaepernick is there, it could be a completely different situation.
Yeah.
It doesn't make Russell Wilson need to be invincible.
We need to bring on a third person to this podcast who, for some reason, is against the Kaepernick signing so that we can have someone to debate, because we're too much in alignment here.
I agree with you more.
It feels like all of Seahawks Twitter is pretty in on this. I don't know if I've seen anyone who's like, oh, no, definitely not.
I think you have to leave Seahawks Twitter. There are people out there.
I'm sure there are. They're probably not listening to this podcast.
And I mean, we can understand what the arguments are if we ignore all of the political arguments. What the arguments would be on the field also. It's not like Colin Kaepernick has impressed anybody over the last couple of years.
Which is the reason, part of the reason he's unsigned right now. But again, you know, if you're evaluating him as a backup, that's a very different lens.
But also, Mike Glennon got paid a lot of money.
Yep. Josh McCown.
So if I was a fan
of... The leader of men.
If I was a fan of one of those teams, I would rather have Colin Kaepernick than those players.
Yeah.
So I can understand that argument. If there is somebody out there who's, you know, poo-pooing this as an idea, I guess I get it. You know, he's not a traditionally great passer. His running is important, but they'd still have to adjust the offense to make sure he was able to run.
Yeah, which makes him a better fit in Seattle than many places. All right, with that... Should we take some listener questions?
Oh, absolutely we should.
We submitted this request on Twitter to do a little bit of a mailbag here at the end of the podcast. If you're not on Twitter, you can also submit questions using peltoncast@gmail.com if you'd like to do that.
And it really felt like you have so much experience asking questions from the basketball analogy, basketball friends. What is it called?
Still the basketball analogy at this point.
Maybe basketball friends.
Maybe, but it's looking unlikely at this point.
Okay. From your basketball friends, Friday mailbags, it seemed like it would make sense for you to take some Seattle-based questions.
Absolutely. So let's go through back through these, starting with loyal listener Chris/C-Styles at C-Styles206 on Twitter. If you could only drink one beer for the rest of your life, what would it be?
It's Rainier.
I mean, obviously.
Although, I don't know. Like, it's a complicated question. If we're on a desert island... Right? Because there's two ways to ask that. Because part of the reason you drink Rainier is because you live in Seattle and you want to be drinking Rainier. Right?
Yes.
It's not just the taste, although the taste is great. But if we're talking a desert island type situation and you can only drink one beer, probably still Rainier, because I feel like you're going to want a lighter beer if you're on a desert island.
Exactly. And that's why Rainier is the choice here, even if I don't think it's like the single best beer in the world. Like... There's only so many IPAs you can drink. Like, yes. Rainier, you can drink a large amount of them, and it's good in any circumstance.
Yeah. You so can throw a lime in there. It'll taste like a completely different beer.
Be perfect for that deserted island.
Especially if the deserted island has limes.
Yes. Hopefully it has avocados. Then you could make enough money to buy a house.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Loyal listener Ben B. at Guga31BB. That's how I've always pronounced that. I don't know if that's actually accurate. G-U-G-A 31-BB. When you two watched Seahawks/UW games together, Is KP as calm as he is on podcasts?
No.
Absolutely not.
I want to take this back, though, farther than Seahawks, farther than Huskies, to the Sonics games. Do you remember, I was trying to think of exactly which game this was. Now, things would get riled up a little bit.
When we're watching at home, or we're in section 222?
No, section 222, I think we're generally pretty calm. Like, what?
I yelled some things.
When Pelton Caracinos get into, Caracinos. When Caracinos get into public, they're generally pretty tame, right?
I suppose.
But in the privacy of our own homes, we're all insane people. Do you remember, I think this was a Sonics game, and I feel like it was against the Utah Jazz. And it was a road game we were watching at your house, and I'm pretty sure that you punched me.
I thought we talked about this on the podcast, that was the last time we got into a fight.
The last time we got into a fight was because you were so angry about a Sonics game. I don't even know what I was doing to make you punch me.
I'm just going to assume you deserved it. Maybe retroactively have deserved it some times after that.
But also, the thing about watching a game with you is you will turn on your team so fast.
That's a major source of contention. Like, you remember the Huskies playing West Virginia in the Sweet 16?
That's one that stands out. I don't remember that game that much. Like, I was being positive and you'd turn on the team?
Oh, yeah. I gave up hope very quickly and you guys were very upset about it.
There's a lot of yelling when we watch games together. I feel like this season, so the one thing that you don't get behind, here are the things about you watching games.
Okay.
You will turn your back on your team almost immediately.
I mean, I don't know what turn your back necessarily means in this context. I'm very pessimistic.
Yes.
Is like a coping mechanism.
You will loudly and aggressively complain about the team that you're cheering for.
Yeah, that's true.
The thing that I do that annoys you the most is complain about referees.
Oh, yeah.
So you do not get behind blaming anything else except for blaming your own team.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying I'll never criticize the referees, but it's just I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt in every situation.
But it is not like when we're here, let's say we're watching a Seahawks game. I'm always imagining like a Sunday night or something.
I mean, I feel like the fact that there are small children here kind of changes the tenor a little bit now.
Not that much, though.
You don't think so?
Maybe a little bit.
I mean, I feel like there's less like yelling and more like just angry tension. Angry, quiet tension.
Angry, quiet tension. But there's a lot of aggression that happens when we're watching, say, a Seahawks game.
Yeah, that's fair. There's a lot of aggressive high-fiving.
Oh, yeah. And both positive and negative. You know, we're feeling the highs and the lows of the game.
Which is really the thing I try the most not to do in real life.
It's funny because I remember you saying something about, you were talking about a basketball game or whatever, and you're like, this was a Husky game. You're like, I don't even judge whether the shots go in. Oh, I just judge whether it's a good shot or not. And I'm like, that is ridiculous that you're saying this. You don't judge whether the shots go in.
I mean, I think the one thing I am a homer about is I will like think the process is good and the results are not matching the process.
Uh-huh, that's why you supported Lorenzo Romar for 3 or 4 years too long now.
Oh, yeah, you're really happy they fired Lorenzo Romar. You're excited about that?
When we watch Husky basketball games, I would say that the tone was generally morose. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, this season that definitely was, yeah.
and there's just like a certain knowledge that you know that the team is going to lose. Like they had a lot of games this year where they would be playing pretty well, and you're like, they're going to lose by 20 points. We all know this. I'm not even getting excited.
Yep.
So, but yes, it's a much more aggressive experience than it is listening to this conversation.
Yeah, you know, I think I'm able to calm down and process things pretty quickly afterwards, but not necessarily in the heat of the game.
No, like we could watch a game and then immediately right after have like a super calm conversation and start rationalizing right away.
Yep.
That's another good,
very good at
Caracino ability is to rationalize ASAP.
All right. Good question there. Coleslaw at Cole, C-O-A-L, Slaw 21 asks, will Russell Wilson's frame and reliance on speed/agility lead to a sharp decline around age 30, 31, like point guards in the NBA not named Chris Paul? So
I was going to let you handle this one.
Yeah, I don't know if I necessarily see the comparison between point guard and quarterback because of the fact that, you know, in Well, Russell obviously is using his speed and the agility a lot of the time. Still, the vast majority of plays, like, it's your the quality of your decision making, and then your arm strength, your ability to deliver the football, are like the two primary things. Much more than, you know, in basketball, so much of it is about your ability to turn the corner and get to the basket. And when that goes for an undersized point guard, like, you know, Tony Parker, for example, then that's where they tend to decline pretty quickly. I would say that what I expect in terms of Russell Wilson's development is that, you know, just a gradual development from into more of a pocket passing.
We've really been waiting for this for a long time. And I think...
Well, we saw it in the second half of 2015.
That really is the perfect Russell Wilson. And if we could have second half of 2015 Russell Wilson for a full season, he'd probably win an MVP.
Oh, for sure.
But we know that it's there. The quarterback who he reminds me of in some ways is somebody like Drew Brees, right? Drew Brees is not a tall quarterback, and the thing that he can do is just move around in the pocket. And I think that Russell, even if he loses a step of quickness, will be able to move around and find whatever the space is that he needs to make the throws.
Yeah, and I mean, he'll have to adjust his risk tolerance because, you know, part of the reason the Seahawks have as many sacks as they do is that sometimes Russell will try to make a play to a fault. In terms of that, this is something we'll yell about for sure. Not as much as other fans. That's the other thing I'll do when we're at games is complain about other fans.
Oh yeah, you complaining love about the team. To complain about other fans
because they're always complaining about Russell Wilson. Like, guys,
complain about other fans complaining.
Like, remember, seriously, remember the Super Bowl?
Colin Kaepernick went to the Super Bowl. So.
He didn't win it. My comparison for how he was going to age was going to be Mark Brunell, who got kind of bulky late in his career after being an extremely athletic quarterback. When he
Russell starts having children, I mean, he's going to get that dad strength.
Wait, there we go. Got that now. That's kind of my comparison in my head, even though I think that Russell is at a higher
Mark
level.
Mark Brunell was an athletic quarterback deep into his career.
Yeah.
It's not like he completely lost that.
And despite like tearing his ACL at UW.
There honestly haven't been that many, what I would say are fast quarterbacks, who've also been good passers.
Yeah.
So I think about some of the historical, like, good running quarterbacks, and most of them actually were bad quarterbacks. And that's kind of what Russell Wilson has, is he's a good running quarterback, and he's just a good quarterback. He's a good and accurate passing quarterback. So it's kind of hard to even find players to compare him to. I guess Mark Brunell is an interesting one, though.
You know what would be an even more extreme version of this would be Randall Cunningham, who was, you know, certainly one of the most athletic quarterbacks in NFL history, and a good passer early in his career. But then even after that athleticism largely faded, you know, deep into his 30s, he was a great passing quarterback in that Minnesota system.
Yeah, wasn't he like 40 years old in that year?
Something like that, when he was throwing the ball up to Randy Moss and Chris Carter. So if the Seahawks could get two Hall of Fame wide receivers to go with Russell Wilson, that'd be great too.
But I guess there have been athletic quarterbacks. Flutie was an athletic quarterback.
That's a good one.
Athletic quarterbacks who've been able to play at a very high level deeper into their careers.
Yeah. All right. Mike Jeremiah at Mike Jeremiah 123 asks, if you had to replace home of the Super Bowl 48 champions with another tagline to describe Renton, what would it be?
Okay.
Obviously the answer here is ahead of the curve, right?
No, I've got a couple of these.
Okay.
That's just the official statement. You can't go with the official.
But it was such a great slogan when they first rolled it out because they had John Keister doing the commercials in a classic callback to Almost Live, constantly making fun of the city of Renton back in the 1990s.
Okay, here's the couple that I've got.
Okay.
Okay. Home of the Super Bowl 49 participant Seattle Seahawks before they cancel the game.
that's a little wordy.
City that is right next to the home of Kenny Mayne.
And right next to the home of the WHL champion Seattle Thunderbirds.
There we go. Home of Taco Time Northwest.
That is true. That's a claim to fame.
Final home of Jimi Hendrix.
Oh, yeah.
From Renton, Washington, home of IKEA meatballs. Because you need to come to Renton if you want to go to IKEA.
It's like the Northwest home for that. They do have them elsewhere.
And most importantly, from Renton, Washington, home of the fabulous Pelton Cast.
There you go. That's how other podcasts are going to refer to it in the future when they start recording out of Renton. Well, excellent work there. All right, lastly.
Thank you.
Michael Roch at LionButt_3 asks, why is Bumbershoot...
LionButt3.
why is Bumbershoot so expensive now? Also, what's your ranking of Seattle's concert venues? So I'm going to defer this one as well to you.
Okay, so I have... Bumbershoot's a complicated one. I served on a board that helped book Bumbershoot for a number of years, right? So I feel like it's a festival and went to it for a long time. I think there are a couple issues with Bumbershoot, which the primary one is just history, right? Because festivals that have been around basically before the festival bubble that happened in the last 15 to 20 years have difficulty because obviously events that were around in the 70s, 80s, 90s were much cheaper than they are now today.
Yes. Right?
I mean, if you looked at inflation-wise, it's still more expensive.
Right, even after you adjust for inflation.
Festivals in general are just more expensive.
It's our concert tickets.
Yes, concerts are more expensive. So I think that's one of the big problems. The other issue is that they're kind of fighting this push and pull of people wanting huge artists to play Bumbershoot, but also wanting it to be very cheap. And it's something that caught up with Bumbershoot by like the early to mid 2000s, maybe late 2008 through 2012 or something like that. And then eventually led to the transition to it becoming part of AG. And I think what they've struck now is it's an expensive ticket because all festivals are expensive. But it's like, I was looking at it today, it's like $250 for a weekend pass. But if you look at, I'm pretty sure Sasquatch is more expensive. Festivals, if you look at like Boston Calling in Boston, all of the major festivals around the country are more expensive festivals.
I like that that was your first example of a major festival.
Well, I mean, the top tier is hard to compare to because it's not Coachella.
Okay.
You know, it's not Coachella. It's not Lollapalooza. They don't have those kind of artists. But I think that they've struck a really good balance lately of having, like, I saw the lineup this year and was genuinely impressed with the lineup.
Wait, is that out there?
Yeah, it's out there.
Okay.
There are artists who are very timely artists who are putting out pop music. And also, you know, they have artists for the kids. They have electronic artists. I think it's a good festival lineup. And it also is not insanely expensive.
Okay.
So I feel like they have the balance between those two things. Yeah, we're going to go see Lorde.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. There's Lorde, Gucci Mane, Flo Rida.
I guess I may have seen that at some point. Oh, Solange.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm excited for it.
Big Sean.
It's going to be fun. But so I think
the roots.
I think one of the real issues is that people just expect it to be really cheap, but you can't have a festival that's that cheap and also have talent at that high level.
Little boats coming?
Oh yeah, I can't wait to talk about this. I'm so excited to talk about Bumbershoot. We can go through it artist by artist. E40 will be here, but then also the second question was to rank my top venues or what are some of my favorite venues. So I went with a top five ranking,
a classic Pelton Cast top five.
Understanding that at least one of these, a couple of them are a little bit political.
you've got relationships to protect here.
But at number one, I went with Numos. Numos is, it's kind of the perfect size venue where you hit artists. You can have some of the smaller artists, but you also hit artists on their way up. You know, it's like the XX play their first ever show in Seattle and it's at Numos. Arcade Fire play their first ever show in Seattle and it's at Numos. It's like you can have these artists and they'll probably sell it out and you know they're moving on to something bigger, but they're still playing at that size of room. So I feel like it's the right size. They just remodeled it. Supposedly there's going to be air conditioning in there so it won't be a million degrees over the summer. The balcony's been redone. It's just a good experience being there. It feels good being at that venue. Number two, I went to Showbox. The OG Showbox from 100 years ago, Showbox Market. And I just like the Showbox. Seen a lot of things there, right?
Men in Blazers.
I've seen Men in Blazers.
Portlandia.
Seen Portlandia. but it's the type of venue where it still feels intimate, but you can see big artists.
Okay.
I think that's kind of its main selling point. I like the two bars in the back on each side because you can stand up there and see everything. I think of when Macklemore, right? When Macklemore first became a huge artist, you remember he announced one show at the Showbox and sold it out, then announced a second show at the Showbox and sold it out, then announced a third show at the Showbox and sold it out. It was kind of like a rite of passage for him. Like selling out Numos would have been fine, but it wouldn't have meant the same as selling out three nights at the Showbox.
And then he announced a fourth, and they didn't sell any tickets at all.
Zero tickets. But at those shows, Sir Mix-a-Lot came to him and passed the torch to Macklemore at that show. Were you there?
No.
How are you not there?
I don't know. I don't think I've ever been to an actual music show at the Showbox. I've only been to Portlandia and Men in Blazers.
Wow. You knew a single music show there?
I don't think so.
I've been to a lot.
You go to a lot more shows than I do.
But it's the type of place where selling out the Showbox means something. You know, for a local artist, it means something, and it's an important place. It's one of the longest-running venues. It has kind of that historical aspect, and it's still a pretty good size. It's not huge. You know, you don't feel like you're completely removed from the artist. And number three, I went for the place that I go to work every day, and that is Seattle's historic Paramount Theater.
Your commitment to always calling it Seattle's historic Paramount Theater is so impressive to me.
The Paramount, when it's for the right show, it would be number one. Like, seeing Sufjan Stevens there,
yep,
is like, there's no other place that you should see Sufjan Stevens. There are some artists who might make a little bit more sense at a smaller place where it'll feel a little bit more intimate. But for artists who are able to sell out theaters and putting on this like pristine music, there's no place that's better for it. Right.
Okay.
So the Paramount, and also being able to configure both standing and seated on the floor is huge. They have chairs that you flip a switch and it takes like 6 hours, but the chairs actually go under the floor.
I kind of am fascinated now to see this.
It's a very long process. There might be a time-lapse video online. But being able to do both is a huge thing, because having a GA floor for some artists is so much better. Like, seeing Glass Animals there, it's like you wouldn't want to go and sit in a chair and watch Glass Animals, but they're a big enough artist that they can play there and sell it out. At number four, I went with the Sunset in Ballard.
Interesting.
So the Sunset recently was remodeled. You know, it was kind of a hole in the wall for a long time. And they did this remodel and completely changed kind of what the venue is. And now it's the first stop for a lot of artists when they're coming through Seattle. So they've done a good job of attracting national artists who are only wanting to play at a 200 cap venue. Seeing somebody like Whitney there, right? Like, Whitney sells it out, but it still feels great. And it feels like you're right there with them. You know, if there's a show that's a good show, it sounds good, it's the exact right size for a lot of artists who are touring. They've got a little bar in the front, which feels really good. It's a great place to go to. I was asking one of my coworkers today about his list, and I think he listed the Sunset as number one.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, we're excited about this remodel. It's a good place to be. If you have a band that can sell 200 tickets in Seattle, this is the place to be.
Okay.
At number five, I went with the place that I worked for 7 years, and that is the Vera Project, because I worked there and booked the venue for 7 years. but also, as far as seeing an all-ages show, and when it's full, it feels really good to be there.
Yeah, I recall that I think the fullest show I attended there was Of Montreal, right?
Oh, yeah, that seems about right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know every show that you went to. But
do you recall that being a good crowd?
Yeah. It was sold out. It was sold out months in advance. But them, seeing Starfucker there a few times, it just feels really good in the room. There's a lot of energy that happens. And seeing kids so excited about being there.
You know, it was disappointing. They never played the Outback song.
Of Montreal didn't?
Well, they played the
original song. They just didn't play Let's Go Outback tonight. but also, it's a weird room. The Vera Project is so big. You know, like, the ceilings are very high. You can do a lot of stuff in there. There's a band that set up a circus tent inside of the venue.
Really?
Yeah, and it has the little balcony. There's a lot of things that you can do with the room. And if there's a good crowd, it feels really good to be in there.
Okay. Well, there we go. All right, well, that was all the questions we had this week. Really appreciate those. Like I mentioned, either at PeltonCast on Twitter or PeltonCast@gmail.com. Don't know how often we'll do these, but we'll try to make it a semi-regular feature.
Feel free to ask us questions anytime.
Yeah.
We can just answer them.
Yep. That's not a problem. All right. On that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.